Chapter 88. I got out of the car at 11:28 exactly. The train was 32 miles south of us, maybe just crossing under Route 78, east of Tupelo. I closed my door but left all the windows open. I tossed the key into Reed Riley's lap. I turned away and sensed a figure wide on my left and another wide on my right. Good moves by someone. I had the Beretta, and I could hit one or the other of them, but not both of them. Too much lateral travel between rounds. I waited. Then the figure on my right spoke.
Reacher?
I said, Devereaux? The figure on my left said, Amonroe. I said, what the hell are you two doing here? They converged on me, and I tried to push them away from the car. I said, why are you here? Devereaux said,
did you really think I was going to let him keep me in the diner?
I wish he had, I said. I didn't want either of you to hear anything about this.
You made Riley open the windows. You wanted us to hear.
No, I wanted fresh air. I didn't know you were there.
Why shouldn't we hear?
I didn't want you to know what they were saying about you, and I wanted Monroe to go back to Germany with a clear conscience. Monroe said, my conscience is always clear. But it's easier to play dumb if you really don't know the answer. I never had a problem playing dumb. Some folks think I am. Devereaux said,
I'm glad I heard what they were saying about me.
11:31. The train was 29 miles south of us. We walked away, on the ties, between the rails, leaving the flat green staff car and its passengers behind us. We walked past the old water tower and made it to the crossing. We turned west. 40 yards away, Devereaux's cruiser was parked on the shoulder. Monroe wouldn't get in. He said, he would walk on down to Brannan's bar, where he had left a car he had borrowed. He said he needed to get back to Kellam as soon as possible, to square things away with the captured mortar men, and then to hit the sack ahead of his early start the next morning. We shook hands quite formally, and I thanked him most sincerely for his help, and then he moved away, and within 10 paces he was lost to sight in the dark. Devereaux drove me back to Main Street and parked outside the hotel. 11:36 in the evening. The train was 24 miles away, I said. I checked out of my room. She said,
I still have mine.
I need to make a phone call first. We used the office behind the reception counter. I put a dollar bill on the desk and dialed Garber's office. Maybe the tap was still in place. And maybe it wasn't. It made no difference to me. I got a lieutenant on the line. He said he was the senior person on duty. He said, in fact, he was the only person on duty. Night crew. I asked him if he had paper and pencil handy. He said yes to both. I told him to stand by to take dictation. I told him to mark the finished product urgent and to leave it front and center on Garber's desk for immediate attention first thing in the morning. Ready? I asked him. He said he was. I said, a tragedy occurred late last night in sleepy Carter Crossing, Mississippi, when a car carrying United States Senator Carlton Riley was struck by a passing train. The car was being driven by the senator's son, U.S. Army Captain Reed Riley, who was based at nearby Fort Kellam, Mississippi. Senator Riley, of Missouri, was chairman of the Senate's Armed Services Committee, and Captain Riley, described by the Army as a rising star, was in command of an infantry unit regularly deployed on missions of great sensitivity. Both men died instantly in the accident. Carter County Sheriff Elizabeth Devereaux confirmed that local drivers regularly attempt to beat the train across the road junction in order to avoid a long and inconvenient delay, and it is believed that Captain Riley, recently posted to the area and adventurous in spirit, simply mistimed his approach to the crossing. I paused.
Got that?
The lieutenant said in my ear. Second paragraph, I said. The senator and his son were returning to Fort Kellum after helping the nearby town celebrate Sheriff Devereaux's successful resolution of a local homicide investigation. The killing spree had lasted 9 months, and the five victims included three local women in their 20s, a local teenage boy, and a journalist from nearby Oxford, Mississippi. The male perpetrator, responsible for all five deaths, is described as a militia member and a white supremacist from neighboring Tennessee, and was shot to death earlier in the week in a wooded area close to Fort Kellum by local police while resisting arrest.
Got that? The lieutenant said again.
Start typing, I said, and hung up. 11:42 in the evening. The train was 18 miles away. Room 17 was as plain as room 21 had been. Devereaux had made no attempt to personalize it. She had two battered suitcases propped open for clothes storage, and a spare uniform was hanging off the curtain rail, and there was a book on the night table, and that was it. We sat side by side on her bed, a little shell-shocked, and she said,
"You did everything you could. Justice is done all around, and the army doesn't suffer. You're a good soldier."
I said, "I'm sure they'll find something to complain about."
"But I'm disappointed with the Marine Corps. They shouldn't have cooperated. They stabbed me in the back."
"Not really," I said. "They tried their best. They were under tremendous pressure. They pretended to play ball, but they put in a bunch of coded messages. Two dead people and an invented one? That thing with your rank? Those mistakes had to be deliberate. They made it so the file wouldn't stand up. Not for long. Same with Garber. He was ranting and raving about you, but really, he was acting a part. He was acting out what the reaction was supposed to be. He was challenging me to think."
"Did you believe the file when you first saw it?"
"Honest answer?"
"That's what I expect from you."
"I didn't instantly reject it. It took me a few hours."
"That's slow for you."
"Very," I said.
"You asked me all kinds of weird questions."
"I know," I said. "I'm sorry." Silence. The train was 15 miles away. She said,
"Don't be sorry. I might have believed it myself."
Which was kind of her. She leaned over and kissed me. I went and washed the last dry traces of Carlton Riley's blood off my hands, and then we made love for the sixth time, and it worked out perfectly. The room began to shake right on cue, and the glass on her bathroom shelf began to tinkle, and her floor quivered, and her room door creaked, and our abandoned shoes hopped and moved, and her bed shook and bounced and walked, tiny fractions. And at the very end of it, I was sure I heard a sound like a cymbal crash, vanishingly brief and faint and distant, like an instant metallic explosion, like molecules reduced to atoms. And then the midnight train was gone. Afterward, we showered together, and then I dressed and got ready to head home, to face the music. Devereaux smiled bravely and asked me to drop by any time I was in the area, and I smiled bravely and said I would. I left the hotel and walked up to the silent diner and climbed into the borrowed Buick and drove east, past Fort Kellum's impressive gate, and then onward into Alabama, and then north. No traffic, nighttime hours all the way, and I was back on post before dawn. I hid out and slept 4 hours, and emerged to find that my hasty dictation to Garber's night crew had been adopted by the Army more or less word for word as the official version of events. Tones everywhere were hushed and reverent. There was talk of a posthumous Distinguished Service Medal for Reed Riley, to recognize his time in an unspecified foreign country, and his father was to have a memorial service in a grand D.C. church the following week, to recognize who knew what. I got neither medal nor memorial. I got 30 minutes with Leon Garber. He told me right away the news was not good. The fat staff officer from Kellum's PR squad had done the damage. His call to Benning had bounced around, mostly upward, at a very bad time, and it had been followed by a written report, and as a result of both, I was on the involuntary separation list. Garber said under the circumstances, it would be the work of a moment to get me taken off again. No doubt about that. I could extract a price for my silence. He would broker the deal. Gladly. Then he went quiet. I said, "What?" He said, "But your life wouldn't be worth living. You'd never get promoted again. You'd be terminal at major if you lived to be 100. You'd be deployed to a storage depot in New Jersey. You can get off the separation list, but you'll never get off the shit list. That's how the Army works. You know that. I cover the Army's ass. And the Army will be reminded of that every time it sees you. I have a purple heart and a silver star. But what have you done for me lately?" Garber's clerk gave me a sheet of paper explaining the procedure. I could do it in person at the Pentagon, or I could do it by mail. So I got back in the Buick and headed for D.C. I had to return the car to Negley anyway. I got there a half hour before the banks closed, and I picked one at random and moved my account. They offered me my choice of a toaster oven or a CD player. I took neither one, but I asked for their phone number, and I registered a password. Then I headed over to the Pentagon. I chose the main concourse entrance, and I got halfway to the door, and then I stopped. The crowd carried on around me, oblivious. I didn't want to go in. I borrowed a pen from an impatient passerby, and I signed my form, and I dropped it in a mailbox. Then I walked through the graveyard and out the main gate to the tangle of roads between it and the river. I was 36 years old, a citizen of a country I had barely seen, and there were places to go, and there were things to do. There were cities, and there was countryside. There were mountains, and there were valleys. There were rivers. There were museums, and music, and motels, and clubs, and diners, and bars, and buses. There were battlefields and birthplaces, and legends and roads. There was company, if I wanted it, and there was solitude if I didn't. I picked a road at random, and I put one foot on the curb and one in the traffic lane, and I stuck out my thumb. This is Dick Hill. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Affair by Lee Child. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright, 2011 by Lee Child. Production copyright, 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.